KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. In January, Doñana County introduced a mandatory COVID-19 vaccination policy for some employees. The county says it's a critical safety measure, but some argue the directive infringes on employee rights. And recently, a Doñana County detention officer filed a lawsuit claiming the county did not have the authority to mandate vaccination. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Approximately 390 essential Doñana County employees have been directed to receive the COVID-19 vaccine by the county. The mandate affects public safety personnel, including law enforcement officers and full-time paid firefighters. County Manager Fernando Macias says the directive was issued because the rate of vaccination wasn't increasing quickly enough.
My directive was really more towards approximately 200 to 220 of our employees who had not been vaccinated at this point, to really move them to take advantage of the fact that they measure so high in the priority list for vaccination. And why are they there? They're there because they have the greatest impact in the community.
Miriam Aranjani, an associate professor of law at the University of New Mexico, says government officials can mandate vaccination.
The law is pretty clear that using the state's police power to regulate for the health, safety, and welfare of its citizens, an employer can require vaccinations.
Aranjani pointed to Jacobson v. Massachusetts, a 1905 Supreme Court case that ruled mandatory vaccinations constitutional. But she says just because she believes employers can require vaccinations doesn't mean it's the best solution.
There are some strong arguments for why it's probably not the best approach. One is there are going to be people who don't want to or say that they can't for religious or medical reasons comply with such a requirement. And so as a result, that's going to cause potentially some litigation, some costs.
By mid-February, 93% of county employees had been vaccinated. Of the 390 personnel required to get the COVID-19 vaccine, 9 requests were filed for special accommodation due to religious or medical needs, and 7 were granted. Macias emphasized that the current policy does not impact all 900 county workers, only select employees who work directly on the front lines. He says these employees have a responsibility to the general public because of the essential service they provide.
When it comes to the security of the community, I believe that we have enhanced authority to make sure that we are uniformly providing that service. Put your own individual beliefs aside, because your role is to protect the public. That's what you were hired for.
But critics, like New Mexico attorney Anna Gardner, say that because the vaccine has been given emergency use authorization by the FDA instead of full approval, the legality of the county policy is in question.
They're authorized for marketing and distribution only under the emergency use authorization of the FDA. People don't necessarily understand the difference between, well, the FDA said that they could market it versus approval. People don't really understand that fine distinction. It is experimental. That's the basic bottom line. And because it's experimental, everyone has the absolute right as a human being to refuse it and without consequences of losing their jobs.
Consequences feared by one Doñana County detention officer who filed litigation against the county manager. The officer, represented by Gardner, detailed threats of job loss and write-ups demanding compliance and argued the county should not be able to force employees to get vaccinated. It's a sentiment shared by Paul Castaneda, the Southwest representative for Communication Workers of America, a union which represents Doñana County deputies. While he reports all employees represented by CWA have complied with the mandate or received accommodation, he says the union does not agree with the directive.
We don't believe it should have been mandated. In worst case, I think we should have had some conversation before that type of notice went out to all employees, quite honestly. I mean, not just, you know, from a CWA standpoint, but other unions as well. We were not reached out or even talked to or even told this was coming out until it was actually put out by the county manager.
University of New Mexico Associate Law Professor Miriam Aranjani underscored the importance of public buy-in surrounding vaccination, stressing that individuals should seek out educational resources about public health measures.
So many laws and policies really require that people buy into whatever it is that's being mandated. And so I always think it's important for the public to have access to good information and for all of us members of the public to, you know, to educate ourselves.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Meantime, as you've heard all week long, Texas is lifting a COVID-19 mask mandate that was imposed last summer but has only been lightly enforced. Republican Governor Greg Abbott's announcement this week makes Texas the largest state to do away with a face covering order. The new rule takes effect next week, March 10th. The decision comes as governors across the United States have eased coronavirus restrictions despite warnings from health experts that the outbreak is far from over. Texas has seen a sharp plunge in cases and hospitalizations in recent weeks, but more than 42,000 people have died from the virus in Texas, trailing only California and New York. We wanted to hear more about reaction to this, so we now turn to Texas Tech Public Media's Sarah Self Walbrick.
How's it going?
Here for your second
Come on
dose.
Up. Doing your first dose?
The city of Lubbock's COVID vaccination hub is a well-oiled machine at this point. Thousands of people are vaccinated here each day. Most people are in and out within 30 minutes. The efficiency of this site has led Lubbock to have the highest coronavirus vaccination rate in the state. About a quarter of adults have gotten at least one dose. Takesha Dial got her first shot on Tuesday. She thinks the city is closer to some sense of normalcy.
Hopefully the regulations and the mandates will kind of subside.
A few hours after Dial got her vaccine, that's what happened. Probably sooner than she expected. The Montelongo's dining room is full, and while people visit and eat their lunch, most don't wear masks. Governor Greg Abbott is in the packed Mexican restaurant to announce new policy changes.
It is clear from the recoveries, from the vaccinations, from the reduced hospitalizations, and from the safe practices that Texans are using that state mandates are no longer needed.
The governor says he's overturning two COVID prevention measures in place since last summer. Starting next week, businesses can open at full capacity.
Also, I am ending the statewide mask mandate.
Yeah. Abbott says he wants businesses and individuals to choose what's right for them, while still urging
personal vigilance to follow the safe standards is still needed to contain COVID.
Just last week, when asked how much longer people will have to wear a mask, Lubbock's health authority, Dr. Ron Cook, said it's possible enough Texans would be vaccinated by the summer.
Masks work, and we must continue to wear masks for now.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention advised earlier this week that it is too soon for states to lift COVID-19 restrictions. Some Lubbockites feel the same way.
My name's Christy Gimza, and I've been a nurse practitioner for over 20 years.
Gimza volunteers at Lubbock's COVID vaccination hub.
His messaging may be personal responsibility, but it's clear many people will get the wrong message and take this as a sign to stop taking precautions.
She says she has a hard time believing that Abbott's decision was based on science. Experts still say that distancing and masking are necessary. Still, Dr. Craig Rhine from Covenant Health says most people will probably keep doing what they've done for the past year, whether that means following medical advice or not.
And those that have been resistant to wearing a mask will continue to do exactly what they've been doing, which is not wearing a mask when they should be wearing a mask.
Local health officials have said people continuing to follow health recommendations has significantly contributed to Lubbock's drop in COVID cases. The city has experienced three surges. And for most of the past year, hospitals have stayed full and death rates high. Right now, there are fewer than 300 confirmed cases in the city. That's the lowest number since June. I'm Sarah Self-Walbrick in Lubbock.
Mexico's COVID-19 vaccine supply is still limited, but on the border, health authorities in Mexico's largest state want to get ready now. And they're looking to learn from vaccination efforts in El Paso. KTEP's Angela Cocherga was there recently as they toured the vaccination clinic at the University of Texas at El Paso.
Students and faculty from the university's schools of pharmacy and nursing run the vaccination clinic.
Some of the students who were vaccinating other students live in Juarez.
That's UTEP President Heather Wilson. She says sharing best practices benefits both sides of the border.
It's a very close relationship. It has been for a long time, and we're very happy to help as Juarez and the state of Chihuahua sets up their vaccination program.
The Secretary of Health for Chihuahua, Eduardo Fernandez, says when it comes to an airborne virus, a binational approach is essential. COVID does not recognize borders. So far, the state of Chihuahua has only gotten enough doses to vaccinate 3% of the population, mostly healthcare workers in direct contact with COVID patients. The clinic tour was organized by the Medical Center of the Americas Foundation. Emma Schwartz directs the organization, which works to expand the region's healthcare capacity.
We have to take matters into our own hands. We have to stop waiting for other people to save us, and we need to figure out what actions we actually take, which resources we actually have at our disposal.
The highlight of the tour, a shipment of vaccines happened to arrive at UTEP while the visitors were on campus. Chihuahua health officials say the visit to UTEP's clinic will help them develop their own strategy to start quickly giving shots once Mexico has enough doses. I'm Angela Cocherga in El Paso.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports overdose deaths have increased during the pandemic, and many people are delaying or avoiding medical care due to concerns about the virus. The New Mexico Crisis and Access Line decided to partner with Digital Therapeutics Group so those living with addictions can get support online. Launched in November with funding from the state, the Five Actions program is free and anonymous. KUNM's Nash Jones spoke with the app's creator, John Fitzgerald, to learn more about the program.
We call it a self-guided roadmap. So it includes a variety of educational videos, all 3 to 5 minutes long, a variety of self-assessment tools. And what's unique about the program is that it comes with 24/7 phone support from the New Mexico Crisis and Access Line.
The program is for those who live with addictions. Are we just talking about substance use and abuse or other addictive behaviors as well?
All addictions, both substance and behavior. And the reason is that the brain doesn't know the difference. People struggle with a package of addictions. Very few people have just one particular substance or behavior. When I say behavior, I mean sex, food, gambling, technology.
You know, the COVID-19 pandemic is a unique time to launch an addictions treatment app. Can you speak to the need for it in this moment, both in content and design?
People can use these 24/7 from the safety of their home, and they're badly needed right now. The CDC released a report, and I think there were nationally 81,000 overdose deaths, which is the highest that they've ever reported. The next report that comes out is likely to have a higher rate of overdose death. The pandemic has absolutely increased addiction, mental health, and overdose deaths.
New Mexico has had the highest alcohol-related death rate in the country for nearly 25 years, according to our Department of Health, at twice the national average. We also had the 12th highest rate of drug overdoses in 2019, mostly from opioids, with fentanyl deaths increasing over 90% in just a year. What is unique about our state when it comes to drug and alcohol addiction, and is the New Mexico-based Five Actions program localized to respond to our specific community?
Part of what makes New Mexico unique is that there's an incredible need and there's limited resources, which is creating a gap. There was a report that said that in 2018, there were about 70,000 people that were in substance abuse treatment. But at that same time, there were about 200,000 people living with substance use disorders, which created a gap of around 135,000 people. One of the primary drivers behind the Five Actions program is to put something out there to meet the needs of that gap, those 135,000 people that aren't receiving any kind of treatment.
So speaking of that gap, according to data from the Department of Health, Native Americans in New Mexico experience the highest rates of alcohol-related death. We also know that they're disproportionately unable to access high-speed internet based on the infrastructure here in New Mexico. And as more services have gone online over the pandemic, we know that that disparity has been exacerbated. So what can those who don't have reliable online access do to seek support through the program?
It is one of the limitations of the program. These streaming videos require high-speed internet. So one of the opportunities is to look at social service agencies, libraries that may be able to host the site or provide access to people. One of the benefits of this program is that it's free to use by anybody in the state of New Mexico. For those who are much more in the trenches of reaching out to people that don't have access to high-speed internet, we're hoping that they can work with us to get the program out to those folks.
I know you just recently launched the program here in New Mexico, but how's it going so far? Are people using it? Does it appear to be making an impact?
At this point, we're getting people signing up on a daily basis. I believe we're around 300 people. You know, 300 people is a good start, but you know, that's a small number compared to that gap that I talked about of 135,000. I think part of that is getting the word out that this is a program where we really want to provide something that people can be anonymous. They can go in and check it out without any risk.
So if someone listening feels like they want to learn more or even give it a try, what are the next steps?
Go to the website, which is nm5actions.com. They would put in their email and that would enter them into a dashboard where they would have access to all of the videos, all the screening tools. This program also provides support and help for families that are looking to help a loved one with substance use or behavioral addictions.
John Fitzgerald, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, COVID-19, also the focus in the nation's capital, the Biden administration's $1.9 trillion relief plan passed the U.S. House last week, and now it is being debated in the Senate. I talked about that with New Mexico U.S. Senator Ben Ray Lujan.
People across New Mexico are still hurting. They're feeling the pain of COVID-19. So many of our families across New Mexico have lost loved ones. We'll never be able to make them whole. But for everyone that has recovered or is recovering from COVID, for all the small businesses that need support, for all of the schools that need financial support to be able to open as safely and as soon as possible, to be able to help our local communities like the county of Doñana or the city of Las Cruces or of Santa Teresa, they also need help because their budgets have taken a hit. And it's important that they're also able to receive direct help so that they can make sure that they keep the police departments strong and working, the fire departments, programs for senior centers as well in their communities. And then direct payments. So many people across New Mexico that have been hit hard, this package will include an additional $1,400 in a direct payment, which that coupled with the $600 that families received at the end of 2020, that adds up to $2,000 in direct payments. The package also includes a significant investment so that we can get more vaccine distributed and into people's arms. We know that we need more vaccine, and we have a lot of incredible healthcare providers across New Mexico that are working around the clock, not just to help people that have been diagnosed with COVID, but making sure that they're getting that vaccine into people's arms. So that's just an example of some of the important programs that are included in the American Rescue Plan that I think will make a big difference for families across New Mexico. And it's why I feel the urgency, and I'm hoping that all my colleagues in the U.S. Senate feel the urgency to get this signed into law, get this adopted and sent to the president as soon as possible.
Well, of course, I know you've been talking to people about this. You had a virtual tour in communities across New Mexico, including in our area in Doñana, Grant, and Sierra counties. What are you hearing from people, Senator, in terms of how this bill could help? And are you hearing anything that's not in the bill that still needs to be addressed once you are able to pass something in terms of pandemic relief?
Well, the answer to both questions, Fred, is yes. I did and have learned from some of our leaders throughout New Mexico, including with my work week period from last week. It was the first work period we've had since I was sworn into the United States Senate. And I did my due diligence. We reached out to leaders in 11 counties, predominantly more rural counties in New Mexico. And as you pointed out, the conversations I had with leaders out of Doña Ana, out of Grant, out of Hidalgo, out of Sierra, and also all the way to Lee and to Catron counties made a big difference in me being able to chat with folks. We also talked to folks all the way, as I said, Hidalgo, Curry, Rio Riba, McKinley, Colfax, Union, and Quay, and even out in Roosevelt near Portales. But the conversation that I had with the leaders down in Doña Ana, Grant, and Catron, and Sierra counties, it was about the impact from an economic perspective with how businesses have been hurt and how they need help, and also with access to care, namely vaccine distribution, more support for rural health clinics and facilities as well. And in each and every one of those are included in the American Rescue Plan. Now, the second part of your question, what still needs to be done? Well, I've been able to advocate for the inclusion of billions of dollars in the American Rescue Plan to help with the digital divide where communities are not connected. There is substantial work that will be needed after this, which I would argue is going to be essential for an infrastructure package that needs to be considered by the House and the Senate and sent to the President. One of my colleagues in the House, for example, Mr. Clyburn, just introduced a package that is a $100 billion initiative, which mirrors an $86 billion initiative that I worked on with him when I was in the House and that I will continue working with my colleagues in the Senate. That's to get us to get connected in rural and tribal communities across America, and especially in our southern counties in our state. Fred, as you know, we know the difference between fast internet, slow internet, and no internet. And we all need to make sure that we have access to internet in our communities.
And you can listen to my full interview with Senator Ben Ray Lujan at krwg.org. KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Great to be with you. The Las Cruces City Council voted to support state legislation aimed at increasing housing protections during this week's council meeting. In depth, once again, here's Madison Staten.
New Mexico House Bill 111 seeks to expand housing protections for those facing discrimination or eviction. A resolution to support the legislation was adopted by the Las Cruces City Council, with Councilor Joanna Bencomo emphasizing that the city must take a central role in the fight against housing discrimination.
I really believe that the city of Las Cruces also must really commit to figuring out how we also hear these concerns here locally, and, you know, not just letting folks know, well, go to the state or whatever. It's important that we also figure out a way to centralize some of that.
City policy analyst Christopher Dunn outlined how the bill will help to protect against a surge in homelessness after pandemic housing protections expire.
When those protections end, there's a large concern that many tenants will be evicted and join the population of homeless in the state of New Mexico. This is largely because tenants in many areas, including and especially in rural areas of the state, are currently unable to abide by their rental agreement owing to their unemployment status that's resulting from the pandemic.
Dunn says House Bill 111 will lengthen the eviction process significantly, giving time for residents to make payments or find replacement housing. Currently, state law allows landlords to start eviction proceedings 3 days after a tenant misses their payment date, something that would be amended under House Bill 111.
In the event that they're late on their rent, they would have 4 days before a landlord or property owner could actually go and give them a status of non-payment of rent. Following that receipt of a status of non-payment of rent, the landlord or property owner would have to wait 10 days before they could initiate that eviction proceeding. And then once they were actually delivered with a summons to appear in court for an eviction proceeding, after that summons, they would currently have a minimum of 10 days that they have to have before the court date is set. House Bill 111 would extend that to 20 days.
New Mexico state law does not currently protect from tenant discrimination based on the source of income, such as those using housing vouchers or unemployment assistance. It's something City Housing and Neighborhood Services Manager Natalie Green says the city is committed to fighting. regardless of whether the protection passes under House Bill 111.
Staff is monitoring this bill very closely. One of the things that we're looking at in particular is the discrimination against income. As we know, that continues to be a problem within city limits. So many of our most vulnerable tenants in the city have a voucher and our landlords aren't taking those vouchers. So that is a particular priority area. And even if this bill does not pass, it is an item that Housing and Neighborhood Services will be tackling in the coming 5 years as part of the consolidated plan.
Councillor Cassandra Gondra says House Bill 111 is just the jumping off point, and that the City of Las Cruces will continue to explore how best to serve its residents.
Just making known what's, you know, happening in the southwest quadrant of the state related to housing issues. We have a lot of major concern, particularly because of COVID, with evictions and sort of discriminatory practices throughout the state, and specifically, obviously, here with the City of Las Cruces. So I know this isn't everything that they would have liked to see in this bill, but enough to start something.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Asylum seekers are being allowed to cross the border again in El Paso, about 25 people each day. As KERA's Mallory Falk reports, relief agencies are preparing as the Sun City joins other border towns in the Biden administration effort.
Ruben Garcia directs Annunciation House, an El Paso nonprofit that provides temporary shelter to migrants and refugees. He says more asylum seekers will cross in the coming weeks, gradually increasing from 25 per day to 50, then more.
Individuals will arrive. They will be welcome. They'll be able to sleep. Very, very important and critical to all of these individuals, some of whom have been waiting in Mexico close to 2 years in very, very challenging conditions.
They'll stay at the hospitality site for between 1 and 4 days, then join family members in other parts of the country. Small groups of asylum seekers have already entered San Diego and Brownsville. All must test negative for COVID in Mexico before crossing into the U.S. For now, only asylum seekers who were placed and remain in Mexico and still have active cases in U.S. Immigration Court are eligible to enter. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
A year ago, the StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative visited Las Cruces. Every week, we are presenting portions of those interviews. Today, Vietnam veteran Lieutenant Colonel Randall Aragon tells his story to Luigi Villanueva of StoryCorps.
I was born in Manhattan, New York, in a section, believe it or not, was called Hell's Kitchen. It was a very tough section. We moved to Brooklyn when I was 12, stayed there until I was 17. I joined the Army. Couldn't wait to leave.
What year was this when you joined?
1963. I went off to another country called Fort Dix, New Jersey. I was going to be definitely an aviation maintenance, and they sent me to aviation school. And that was another country that I'd never been to called Fort Rucker, Alabama, which was for a New York Yankee like me going to the farthest southern part of the world. They couldn't understand me, and I couldn't understand them because, you know, we're talking about deep south.
Yeah, so was it hard to adjust when you got to basic?
One thing I do remember, you're talking about 1963. The Civil Rights Act didn't hit until 64. They still were fighting the Civil War in Fort Rucker, Alabama. I had no idea about that. Didn't even know what segregation was. There was a barracks I went to, and there was three sergeants in a room, the sergeant's room, and then an African-American soldier came into the barracks to get his bed, and they got all upset about it. It bothered me. The military changed, thank gosh. So I went, at that point, I stayed for jump school, which was 3 weeks.
Do you remember what it was like the first time?
Yeah. This is an old joke, they say. The first week, they separate the men from the boys. And the second week, they separate the men from the idiots. And the third week, they let the idiots jump. So that's a joke. I have to remember to this day. Yeah.
So what happened after you finished with a jump school in aviation?
I went to the 101st Airborne Division, which is the most combat-ready, rugged unit in the Army at the time. Well, of course, they had another parachute division, 82nd. It's a tough unit, and I stayed there 2.5 more years. From there, I got out, I was 20, thinking the world was waiting for Randall Aragon. Boy, was I wrong. I was going to try to be an aviation mechanic, and I didn't have a license. You have to have a federal, it's called an A&P license, airframe empowerment. I passed three parts of a five-part test, but you needed that to really get a good job. I couldn't find a good job, and I decided, because the Army wanted me to reenlist, I knew that I wanted to go to OCS, Officer Candidate School, and 3 months later, I was in OCS, Officer Candidate School. Finished that as a second lieutenant, started my career as an officer. Back then, you went from second to first after a year, and then you went from first to captain in a year. So 2 years after I was in, I was captain. And what happened was they told me as a first lieutenant, you're going to go to Vietnam. I didn't want to go because, you know, I just, you know, didn't believe in the war. You know, it was a mess. But they said, you're going. You know, you no choice. So I ended up going there as a first lieutenant.
What year did you get to?
I got there 68. About 2 months later, I knew I was going to get promoted. I became a company commander. I had 326 soldiers reporting to me at 24. That same night, do you remember, the same night I took over command, we got attacked. We got hit by mortar. The Tet Offensive, and they're trying to blow us off the map. My guys did a great job. I didn't lose anybody, thank
That's
God.
That's great. Talk about returning to the United States. What was it like when you got out?
Well, I was still in the Army.
Oh, you're still in, right.
I came back from my 1 year. You served, back then you served a year in Vietnam. And I do remember I was treated very bad. I do remember that. I remember I was trying to get my degree. I wanted to make it a career. And I wore my uniform because I was going to go from school to work. The teacher wouldn't answer when I raised my hand. She acted like, she was my age. She wouldn't even look at me. And the students were, you know, when I walked down the hallway, it was like parting the, you know, the Red Sea. They were looking at me like I had leprosy.
How did you get through that? What was it like to deal with that?
I understood. You know, I spent a year of my life thinking I might be snuffed out any day or lose some of my guys. And here, look at how they're treating me. And, you know, I was there, you know, ordered to be there. But they're making up for it. They've realized they made a mistake, but it was just the world how it was back then.
So you talked about coming back home. When did you finish up in the military? When did you leave?
Okay, I left the Army. I had 12 and a half years active duty. I was a captain. Anyway, I went into law enforcement right after I got out. About a month later, the guard called me, a colonel, and he said, you know, we're really impressed with your record, and we're trying to hire people that have got ex-combat experience. And I was selected, stayed another 12 years, you know, retired as a lieutenant colonel, and became a police chief. And I served proudly, and I missed the military. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. It gave me my education. Gave me my college degree, my four-year degree. I got my master's through the Army. It was the best thing that ever happened to me.
To hear this segment and the full interview with Lieutenant Colonel Aragon and other StoryCorps interviews, check out our StoryCorps page. It's in the radio section at krwg.org. Funding for this segment provided by the Heritage Assisted Living, taking COVID-19 precautions and offering specialized care for their residents, accepting admission in their 3 sanitized homes. More information at 575-525-9215 or heritage-lc.com. The New Mexico Rural Heritage Oral History Project is a collaboration between anthropologists at New Mexico State University and the Oral History Program at the New Mexico Farm and Ranch Heritage Museum in Las Cruces. The goal of the project was to record the memories of New Mexicans who grew up in rural parts of the state in the first half of the 20th century. We continue our journey in the land of enchantment by exploring one of the most essential parts of growing up in New Mexico in the early 20th century. In this episode, a look at life on the farm.
Mary Ellen Warren was born in 1927 on the Sierra Grande Ranch where she grew up.
We had a big garden, and I remember in the springtime we had rhubarb and asparagus. We collected the lamb's quarter. It was a wild green that grew, and we got it to cook. And then we planted lettuce, cabbage, spinach, Swiss chard, turnips, radishes, beets, carrots, onions, sweet peppers, and acorn summer squash. And then we had tomatoes, we had beans. I can remember we raised a lot of pinto beans, and then whenever They dried while we would get the straw out of them. We had English peas. We had Hubbard squash that we raised, and we'd put it in the cellar to use for pumpkin pies in the wintertime. And we put the cabbage in the cellar, and it lasted quite a while. We made our own sauerkraut from the cabbage, and we made hominy from the corn.
Besides growing crops, her family also raised animals.
We had a lot of cows, and we had horses, and we had one section that was, they put millet and corn in it, and of course we fed the millet made good hay for the cows and the horses in the wintertime. And then of course the corn was good for the pigs. We always butchered a beef in the fall, and then we would hang it up in the garage and it'd freeze and it'd stay good. And we usually killed a pig sometime or another during the year and butchered it, and they would cure the meat. We'd make our own sausage, and we put it in syrup buckets and then put lard over it and put that in the cellar, and it would keep. And then we also had, we made our own soap because it had a lot of fat, so we made the soap from that. We had chickens. We raised our own eggs. Now that was one thing that we sold some of. We sold some butter when we worked, but a lot of times we would milk the cows. And well, I guess there was one cow we had to milk at night because we took the calf away from her. But most of the cows we just milked in the mornings, and we had a cream separator, and it would separate the cream from the milk. We would put the cream in cream cans and ship it to Trinidad, and then we'd get the can would come back, and so would the check.
Amado Mares was born in Taos, New Mexico, but shortly after moved to the family ranch in Black Lake, New Mexico, where he would live for 9 years. This is his experience.
We used to gather strawberries.
Oh, you did?
Wild strawberries. Yeah, there was a place up here, maybe 5 miles, I don't know, 3 miles maybe from here in the mountains. And there was a place there where there's a lot of strawberries that grow wild. Everybody would go at the same time, pick. But you don't see that anymore because it's so dry, you know. She used to grow the vegetables, like no corn, but peas, red beets, the hardy vegetables that would grow here. Turnips, radishes and lettuce. Another thing they did a lot that I remember, you know, when it was your turn to cut the hay and store it, because they pile it up, the neighbors would help each other. So there was never money exchange, really. This guy would help you, and then it was his turn to, so somebody would go over there and help. And there were a bunch of boys here growing up. There was no shortage of labor. Well, we had meat, because we had a lot of sheep. But sometimes my friends would hesitate to kill, because they would sell them in the fall. You wouldn't kill the animal that often. Sometimes they kill when, you know, like we get company. For sure they'd end up killing one of the sheep or a lamb or something. Or even a calf. We had plenty of meat, I guess. And we had plenty of potatoes, because my dad would grow a lot of potatoes. We used to get like 300 sacks, 100-pound sacks every fall.
Jerry Navarez was born on July 24th, 1952, in his grandmother's house in San Miguel, New Mexico. Jerry had six siblings. Growing up, Jerry's family owned 14 acres of land south of La Mesa.
Well, we would, now they're called weeds, but there's something called purslane. We call it verdolagas. Those grew plentiful in the farm, so we collected those for food. And the quelite, which are lamb's quarters. We had cactus, which I have some still from the farm you saw who walked in the house. They're originally from the original plant on the farm.
Oh, okay.
Those are
okay.
Harvested during the growing season, and you can cook those up. Asparagus used to grow wild in the ditches. As a little kid, I used to go out and harvest the asparagus. Not anymore, because people, farmers use herbicides now.
Daniel Olguin and his family moved to Washington Ranch in 1944, where he lived until 1951. He describes some of the chores and tasks he had to do while living there at Washington Ranch.
Well, we had a bunch of horses. We fed high gear in bundles that you don't use that anymore.
Daniel is referring to Sudanese grain sorghums that have chalky white seeds. The specific high gear, or hagari, he describes is grown in the Southwest.
In fact, my father, they called it a rope binder. And what it would do, we would grow high gear, which is like maize, only there's a 60-day high gear and a 90-day high gear. There was a difference. It would mature in one of it in 60 days, although it was shorter, and it didn't have the grain as big. The 90-day high gear grew taller and had a bigger clump of seeds, espiga. And my father had a rope binder, and it was pulled by four horses, and it would cut the row of high gear, bundle it, and tie it with the twine. And then it would kick the bundle out, and I used to go behind that row binder, sometimes barefooted, all day. And if the bundle hung, the string hung on this arm, it would tear the bundle up. So if it hung up, I would pull it and drop it down. And I would go back and forth. And my dad was driving the horses.
Why were you barefoot?
That's Daniel's wife, Georgia, who was also present during the interview.
I didn't have any shoes.
Most of the kids didn't have shoes.
And he would rope bind for other people. In fact, I know the farm off of Lee Street where I remember bundling for other people. And then we would take it and shock it in shocks and let it dry. And then after it dried, then you put it on the wagon and haul it into the barn. And that's what the horses ate, and cows. And one time, we had a big, long trough where the horses would be eating the high gear. And the goats would get in there also. And this big horse was eaten. And this goat jumped in between two horses. And this one horse grabbed the goat by the tail and swung it. I mean, that goat goes, bah! I'll never forget that as long as I live.
Part of Daniel's job was providing medical care for animals.
One time we went to Double Canyon that had a pasture over there, and the colts, they had several mares with young colts, and you have to give them some shots, and I don't remember what for, but it was a small pasture, and we'd have to rope them, and then all of us jump on them and hold them down and give them a shot. And I'll never forget, I threw my loop, and I didn't catch him by the head, but I caught him by the front feet and flipped him over like this. And he hit the ground, and then he got up again, and before we could get to him, I pulled again, and he hit the ground again, and we all jumped in it and doctored him right there. That colt just turned a complete flip. Luckily, I didn't kill him.
Yeah, it could have broke his neck.
If they got cut up on the fence, what would you put on it?
There was some stuff they used to call Martin 62, and it was a black medicine that was good for worms. Back then, you used to, there was screw worm. And if there was a calf or any horse that got cut, they'd get screw worms, and then you'd have to doctor them every day. And then that medicine would keep the flies away. The calves that were born, they had their navel was bloody, and so the flies would lay the worms in the navel, and you had to ride the pastures at least every other day. And if there was any of them with screw worms, you had to rope them.
Lonnie Harper was born in 1936. Being one of nine kids, he was hired to work on neighboring farms.
Since I was the youngest of five boys, Dad really didn't
need any more boys to do the farm work. And so he would hire each one of his kids out to a neighbor farmer. You know, that it may be all girls, didn't have. And I remember starting to work when I was 12 years old for an outside farmer. And I got $5 a day and room and board. And Dad would have me a job lined up with a neighbor farmer, you know, or next in the next county. But the farmers learned that Dad's sons were hard workers. If you hired us, we worked 12 hours a day, sun up to sundown, or dark 30. But we would work. And I thought $5 a day and room and board was pretty good money. I'd buy my own school clothes and three pairs of Levi's and three white shirts. That was my school clothes.
One of his jobs on the farm was plowing the fields, as he describes in this next clip.
I started driving a tractor when I was 12 years old. John Deere Poppin' Johnny D John Deere tractor. Two-cylinder, pop, 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 pop. But it was powerful. And it would pull a 12 to 16 foot, what we call a one-way plow. And it's developed in Kansas, and it plows down to about 3 inches deep and turns the soil over and turns the old, you know, like wheat straw and what have you, the mulch, mm-hmm. turn it under and get it to decompose as soon as possible. And with a 12-foot, 16-foot one-way, you could plow up to 40, 60 acres a day. That beats the old one horse. Take a month to plow 40 acres.
Francis Beeman was born in 1930 and grew up in the communities of Malaga and Loving. Both are near Carlsbad, New Mexico. His dad built a ranch house in Malaga.
Late 30s, early 40s. We had some people that worked on the farm, that lived in dugouts on the farm property. And I'm describing there how they built their dugouts. They take whatever size they wanted their house to be, and they dig down about 3 feet and take the dirt out, throw it out, settle it off, and they cut out steps where the door was going to be. Then they take the dirt, and mix it with straw, make adobes, put it on the outside, go up 4 feet, and now you've got 3 feet plus 4 feet, you have a 7-foot ceiling, and then they go out and get salt cedar brush and whatever they could find to put the roof on. They lived in there. The whole family would live in that one dugout. And we had about, I don't know, 7 or 8 of them on our farm. And they all worked for the Beeman Farms. But they did whatever there was to do. Most of them, back in those days, most of the farm work was done with by horse teams. And they drive the cultivators or the discs or the plows, whatever. And so we had the teams of horses, and they'd do that. They'd do whatever farm work there was to do. They lived in those dugouts, and I guess they went down to the river, which is about a half a mile, to wash the clothes, get clean, take a bath, because they had to haul the water up there because they had no drinking water. Dad would send a barrel of water up there to put it out for them. They'd dig it out, use it to drink in. They were poor, and I don't know how to describe it other than to say they were kind of second-class citizens. You know, they were in a situation they couldn't get out of, but they did their best that they could, and most of them were very smart and very talented. They were just being held down by discrimination.
Clinton West was born on January 15th, 1941. He often goes by the nickname Doc West. His family moved to New Mexico from Westville, Oklahoma. In those days, grandparents often helped raise the children. In this next clip, Doc West reminisces about his grandfather and working on the ranch.
That's why I say he taught me a lot. He was a great guy. He would talk to me like I were a grown man. And when we moved out to the ranch, well, my job, milk the cows, feed my hogs, make sure the chickens got fed. And I'd go down to the cattle guard and I'd wait for him to come pick me up. And we'd drive down to the barn and we'd load up some feed. And we'd drive this whole ranch. It was 11 square miles, 11 sections of ranch. And you know, you'll have a little herd over here, half a dozen or more, and they'll be scattered all over the ranch. They don't just stay in one group. And we usually feed what they call cow cake. It's just cylinders of feed that it's wet, and they shove it through an extruder, and it dries, and it's nice and hard. You can throw it on the ground, the cows eat it. And we take some hay. Well, my grandfather liked this whiskey, and we would be driving the ranch, and we'd see a group of cattle, and he'd honk the horn, and they'd come running over, and I'd get in the back and throw some cake out and some hay. And he'd look at me, and he said, "You want to snort, son?" And I said, "Yeah, I think I could do with one." And he'd pull a bottle of Four Roses whiskey out from under the seat of the truck, and he'd take the lid off, and he'd hand it to me. And I'd take a sip, and that was the awfulest tasting stuff I ever drank in my life. But you got to man up, and then I'd hand it back to him, and he'd take a snort. And it may take us a couple of hours to get all the cattle fed, and we'd start to head back to the ranch house. And by then, we'd already had three or four snorts, and he'd bring out a package of mint Lifesavers. And he'd say, "Well, we better start eating this candy so your mama doesn't smell that whiskey on us."
Unfortunately, in the 1950s, a drought similar to the Dust Bowl of the 1930s hit the Southwest. One of the most important jobs Doc had was taking care of baby calves, as described in this last clip.
A couple of years, we had a terrible drought. This was in the mid-50s. And we were losing mama cows right and left. And the little calves without a mama is called a dogie. And I had to take those dogies and teach him how to nurse on a bucket with a nipple on it. Mm-hmm. And boy, you talk about a job, because they're all wild. I mean, they are wild. And I'd go to work and I'd have slobber and milk all over my clothes and my boots. And I got them trained, boy. They'd hear me rattle that bucket and they'd all be right there at the corral wanting to get drinking that milk, because it was just powdered milk and well water. But it kept them alive. But we had a big dirt tank on the back side of the ranch, and the water got down to where there was almost no water, and the mama cows weren't getting enough nourishment because there wasn't anything to eat. And they'd get out there in that mud and they'd get bogged down and they couldn't get out. And we'd drag them out and put them up in a tripod sling, and we'd feed them K-Row syrup and water and penicillin and try to nurse them. We saved some of them, lost a lot of them. We probably lost 30 head in one summer. 30 head of mama cows, that's a lot of cows.
That concludes this episode of the New Mexico Rural Heritage Oral History Project. All interviews were conducted or supervised by Kelly Jenks, Mary Alice Scott, Kayla Archuleta Brown, and Mariah Ballard. On behalf of New Mexico State University, I'm Jose Loera. Thank you for tuning in.
That's KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. Hope you enjoy the rest of your weekend. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, this is KRWG Las Cruces and KRXG Silver City.